Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
March 10th, 2024, episode 242. 1, 2, 3. Hello, everyone. Welcome into the corner. I'm Kevin England, and this is another edition of the Beekeeper's Corner. March is just about halfway done, and it sure is looking like spring around here. Buds are appearing on the tips of the trees. The bees are getting early flying days and bringing in pollen. Colonies are brooding up for the pending spring forage, and, well, in short order, a plant that the bees don't even work, but it's the indicator plant. Forsythia is going to be in bloom, and it'll be game on for the season. I'm actually feeling a sense of accomplishment by getting this release out. Still on a roll for weekly production so far in 24. I've got a bit of pressure for next week as I have zero in the can, but, you know, we'll cross that bridge as the week progresses. As to this episode, it's a bit of a mix, and let me take a moment to tell you what we have in store. Kicking it off, I have a tip to share that has really kept me organized lately when working on my computer. For work, for personal, for beekeeping research, and more. It's a new feature in the Microsoft Edge browser that has changed the way I work for the better, and it's too good not to share. Roundtable number 2, a follow-up to the progression of successful failure. This time I'm going to talk about racking off mead. I already racked it once earlier this year, and now I'm doing it again to keep it off the spent yeasts. And I'm going to share some commentary along with a bit of a lament on what I did to myself. Roundtable number 3, have you ever contemplated the aspects of a bee spill team? I'm going to talk about my thoughts and research about being part of a team that might respond to bee spills, ones where the hives are all over the highway. Roundtable number 4, a follow-up to how long does it take for a colony to know it's queenless? A welcome response came in the inbox. What if we could measure different biological markers to inform us on our beekeeping? For roundtable number 5, I'm going to talk about a USDA study where they're considering a protein for determination of stress and other problems in a colony. I am going to parlay that into how it relates to understanding the triggers of what makes a winter bee, something I'm on a quest for. Last roundtable number 6, 1, 2, 3 bites. So good. A honey-sweetened peanut mix enrobed in dark chocolate. Like I said, so good. I'll tell you how to make them. I'll close out the show with some closing comments and get you on out of here. Before we head in, a quick word about managed mentoring. I'm currently transforming a program that we had used for our local beekeeping club for getting started in beekeeping, and we've created a web-based delivery program. If you're starting in beekeeping, it's free to you. This tool is specifically designed to fill in the gaps of knowledge that you're not finding answers for. We've been training beekeepers for more than a decade in our program, and, well, we're well-versed in the things that are going to trip you up. From setting up your apiary, the unanswered questions about how to bring your bees home, how to feed, setting up a bear fence, and, well, anything else that may come your way, we've answered all those questions, and we've provided a safe place for someone who's getting started to get the right answers without all the other stuff that you get when you go to a bee meeting and they don't take the time to get you the answers you want. We know the questions you will have, and we've crafted the answers. Visit the website, managementoring.com, and browse the first year program. Sign up through the Start Here link on the menu and join our online sessions. This week, we had some beekeepers in from Colorado, Ohio, North Carolina, and plenty of Jersey and PA folks. Take a look. We think you'll be glad you did. And please spread the word. And good luck in your beekeeping season. One last bit of housekeeping. Show notes are available for all our shows at www.bkcorner.org. If you want to reach out to me, my email is kevin@bkcorner.org. And let's say we head in and get things going. Roundtable number one, I call this one workspaces. Every once in a while, I find something that helps me from a productivity standpoint, and it changes the way I work. This is a weird one when it comes to beekeeping, but I have to say that if you're like me, you're going to understand the benefits of this. I know a lot of people use Google Chrome as their web browser. I have to say I've always used Microsoft Edge, and I'm going to bet that I'm in the minority when it comes to my browser selection, but I have my reasons. For what it's worth, I do a lot of work in Microsoft Office 365, my subscription both from work and home, and I use Microsoft Rewards and other programs that Microsoft offers, and things built into the Microsoft browser just work a little better in conjunction with all of that stuff. I think I've talked about Microsoft Rewards in the past. It's a program where you earn points that translates to money to buy things. And I'm proud to say that I'm currently sitting on a 400 plus day streak, which is a record for me. And the points in my lifetime that I've earned are worth hundreds of dollars, but I digress. Let me get to the point of the new feature that was built into the Microsoft Edge browser, and it's become a game changer for me. Like many Americans, post-COVID, I work from home on a lot of days. And while I'm working, I have a browser open that has no less than 5 to 6 windows of various tools I use in the course of doing my job. You can imagine mail, calendar, service desk, and so on. Off to the side at any given time, I have windows open for things in progress. Maybe it's a recipe for dinner. Maybe it's a beekeeping video, or I've checked on the weather, or I'm looking at my stocks. Maybe it's a beekeeping video that I was watching. Or, you know, I always have a handful of articles that I've been reading. In short order, that becomes an absolute mess. This is where this new feature called Workspaces comes in. The browser has a built-in collection capability where you can create custom spaces to hold websites that you have open. I'll give you a couple of examples so you can grasp what I'm talking about. I have a workspace called Beekeeping. As you might imagine, in the production of this show, and simply because I'm always reading about beekeeping, at any given point I have a half dozen or more windows open in a browser. I created a workspace, gave it a unique color theme, and now all my beekeeping pages are open in that workspace. I created an alternate workspace for my work, and another for recipes, and one for YouTube videos, and well, I have one for an everyday general things that I have open. The cool thing about it is, if I hover over my Microsoft Edge browser icon on my taskbar at the bottom of the screen, the workspaces pop up and I can switch interchangeably between them at an instant. And, you know, if I remain disciplined, I keep all my work things on the work one, especially, you know, when I'm working from home, I have no distractions. And when everything is organized in this manner, it's a lot easier to come back to what you were working on and find the things you had open as it's organized based on the category. As speaking of coming back to something, the most amazing feature of this is when you click the X to the workspace and shut everything down for the day. If you want to come back to where you were previously, you simply open the workspace, and it manifests with all the sites you had open. In the course of doing research for beekeeping, this has been an amazing productivity boost. I could keep a number of running articles open, and every time I open the workspace, they all spin up and I pick up where I'm left off. I've had a beekeeping workspace closed, and I just opened it while I'm doing this, And there's a video there that I started with Dr. Zachary Lamison waiting for me, along with a couple other research topics that I'm working on. And even for work, when I log in the morning and open the workspace, it opens my mail, my calendar, a number of other tools that I have to have open all day long. And I have to say, I'm really just digging this. There's one additional sidebar to talk about. I'm guessing that, like me, you have your favorites, meaning literally your browser favorites. And you could probably guess, I'm extremely anal about how I've organized my favorites. Everything has its place. I'm specific about the icons I use so I can recognize them. Yeah, I'm that way about them. When you set up a regular browser, you can have all of your favorites organized in the customary manner that you do. But when it comes to workspaces, you have the option to organize the favorites directly to the workspace independently. You can go to your broad favorites and copy them all in, or you could do what I did. My workspace only has favorites related to things that I do for work, because when I'm in that tab, I'm in the work mode. I can custom curate all of the specifics to the workspace. Now, when I open up my work one, it has links to all the company resources that I use across the ecosystem. And then I add the ones that I'll allow a distraction. Maybe I need to see the weather, so I have a weather one in there. Now, turning to my beekeeping workspace, I have a large contingent of websites and resources that I use when I'm doing things about beekeeping. And I've copied them all out of my generic favorites and populated them into the workspace proper. My favorites bar in my beekeeping workspace, it's all about beekeeping. I don't have a link to my banking site or things that I don't want to look at while I'm in a beekeeping state of mind. And every time I open that workspace, they're right there organized in the manner that I want them. I can make a whole host of specific things that get buried in the favorites bar. You know, different favorite Facebook sites, YouTube pages, blogs, and so on. I think you're getting the gist that it's beekeeping 24/7 in that workspace. In my secret life, I love to look at recipes. My recipe workspace currently has about 20 different recipes in waiting to transfer to my recipe software or something that I'm going to make for dinner soon. Those were, quite frankly, if I have to, you know, be full disclosure, the biggest offender of open tabs in my general life over the last years since COVID, when I picked up this habit. There are times when I'm sitting on a work call and I might go to one of those tabs and copy the recipe into my software while someone's droning on about something that I'm only half invested in. So yes, if you're a Chrome user, you might have to switch to Edge if this is piquing your interest. But I have to say that for all the innovations, quite honestly, most of them are going in the wrong direction. Some of the productivity tools we have these days are dumbing down so awfully. I'm looking at you, Microsoft Outlook. This one has proven to be something I'm really digging, and I wanted to share it with you. Now, there's a side that I've not even mentioned yet, that I've not explored, but it might be interesting to you if you have this requirement. One of the actual premises of creating this workspace thing manifested in its capability that I've not discussed yet. There's a feature built in where you can invite others to your workspace. Collaboratively, you could share with someone else and they will see the tabs you're interacting with. And of course, in a collaboration environment, you can open up a sidebar and you could chat on the side about what you're looking at and scroll together and do all of that stuff. Again, I've not dug in on this, but I know that it's there, and perhaps in time I'll find a requirement to consider this collaborative aspect and check it out. I can imagine that if you're a bunch of beekeepers working on studying for Master Beekeeper and you're browsing websites and doing all that, then sure, you could set up a workspace and collaboratively you could do this together. Just an example. So workspaces, Microsoft Edge, game changer for me, might be something interesting for you to take a peek at. Roundtable number 2, successful failure, Rackageddon. Let me declare that my mistake in formulating the Mead this past December has created one heck of a burden in the downstream processing of the Mead batches that I made. Successful failure has been both rewarding and a stark reminder of a mistake that creates burdens down the line. It's one thing to carve out a bit of time to rack off a batch of mead and make sure whatever you make is well cared for, but given I have gallons and gallons of mead in process, it's required dedicated blocks at inopportune times, for who has time to do this when it takes forever? As I've learned from mead making in the past, when mead is on the spent yeasts, you need to get it off. Miss doing that and you'll be reminded of your mistake with a yeasty overtone in every sip of the mead you make of your future. This year's batches are equally troublesome because they were fruit-based meads and you need to strain out any of the fruit as you remove the mead off of the spent yeast, commonly referred to as lees. Describing the task, you place a hose in the mead bottle and you siphon off the top liquids into the new container. Therein lies the rub. I used almost all the vessels I have in my possession because I overmade all the mead. So doing this required me to rack off one bottle, take that bottle upstairs, and I process things in my basement workshop. So I have to schluck them up to the kitchen and clean that vessel so that I could then rack off the next gallons of mead into that clean container. Bless Sharon as she helped me with the assembly line. There's another dynamic to this in that as you rack things off the mead, the liquid in storage gets smaller and you have to right size it down to a smaller vessel so there's not a lot of oxygen in the top of the mead bottle. You don't want oxygen on your mead, it makes off flavors. So gallons and gallons of mead strained, mixed. The funny thing is we have all these jars that we use for honey, things that we've collected over time. And I have batches that are in 5-gallon carboys, 2-gallon carboys, 1-gallon containers, 2-quart containers, 1-quart containers. A couple of them are in pint containers. I've even used a couple Chinese food containers. There's mead in bottles all over the place. Now, I have to say, all of them are labeled, so I didn't lose track of what they were. Some of them are cherry and peach and regular, and others are blended, different versions. All in all, I think the peach is amazing. The peach boucher came out really good. The cherry is extremely good. I'm not sure that some of the other ones didn't have kind of an off flavor to me. And I don't know if it's just because they're really young. If you make mead and you test them out when they're young, they completely are different from when I test them next December when I go to bottle them. But the important part is none of them had the yeasty overtones. Now, I do something really dumb. I took all of the cherry pulp that was in the bottom and I strained it through coffee filters. And what I've learned is, as laborious as it is to pour the pulp into a coffee filter, one coffee filter at a time, and wait for it overnight to strain, it yields a lot of product. You can get a whole 2 or 3 bottles of mead out of what was there from the 5-gallon batch. And I take that stuff and drink it off to the side. And it's really drinkable and very good. And it takes a lot of work. But you know, in making extracts from COVID, I got used to doing that every day. I used to go tend to it like somebody would tend to their plants. So the job, at least the racking part, is all done. I might look at it again, and if some leaves formulate, I would rack it off again just to make sure that it doesn't sit on it. You know, the one thing that's weird is the wildflower mead did not clear at all. I don't know what it is about that. The rest of them all cleared and look spectacular, and they're probably ready to bottle after they age a little while. The wildflower is still perking away. I don't know why that yeast is so much different. So the job is done, mostly. I'm still straining some of the cherry mead. And well, I agree with the statement that Sergio Mutella once made when he gave a presentation about making mead. You might consider yourself a mead maker, but on the side, you're a glorified janitor. Wow, it's a lot of work to make larger volumes of mead. Roundtable number 3, I call this one the big one. This is a roundtable out of thin air. As my brain works, I don't know why it is this way, I had this thought rattling around that I need to get re-prepared for something I've not seen in my lifetime, but, you know, you never know. What popped in my head is being prepared for an incident involving bees and transport. There was a time when this was raised at the state level and I prepared a kit and threw my hat in the ring for being on that list should the need ever arise. Now, I've never received a call, but always considered that someday, something might happen. And, you know, I'm going to ask you, if it did, would you have been ready to go? So I ask you to consider your situation. Would you ever be in a position to receive this call? I think this is kind of fun. Let's play pretend for a minute and explore the dynamics of the situation. The first thing to consider is, are you even interested? Seems like a yes-no question, but there needs to be consideration, especially if you're going to say yes. It seems on the surface like a simple yes, but if you've ever heard what's involved, it has the potential for being far from simple. To consider that, let's jump right into a worst-case scenario. A truck overturns with a pallet of bees on it. Not too dissimilar from the latest plot in a horror movie, if you think about it. I've had the opportunity to talk to some who have rendered remediation in these type of events. It's described as one of the most challenging things you will ever do in your life, let alone as a beekeeper. The bees are going to be furious. You'll be working fully suited head to toe. It's laborious work. And even if it were a comfortable, cool 50 to 60 degree sunny day, you're going to be overheated through the whole event because you're going to be suited up like you're working a hazmat event. And 50 to 60 degrees is kind. You know, consider likely that it's going to be 70 plus. When do they transport bees? In beautiful weather. Hot summer days. So sticky. Back-breaking work. By likely only a handful of few individuals that can be scrambled. And you're going to be humping non-stop until the job is done. It's not unlike going into battle, and I'm going to throw another wrinkle into it as I perceive it. You're on a major road. The police are going to want that road opened as soon as possible. In my past life, recalling some EMT training from things days gone by, about closing interstates or major corridors, the police require disruption to be remediated efficiently with a capital E, and they're going to pick whatever the most expedient plan is to resolve the situation. This means they're not going to wait for resources. They don't care if you're waiting for a bee suit or protection or tools to move hives from point A to point B. You know, saying this another way, when they're in charge, and they are, you follow their orders. And they have no idea what it takes to fix this situation, but they want it cleaned up immediately. They might yield that you have expertise, and they certainly don't want to be stung. And by the way, the most common story is first responders go in, everybody gets stung, and then they're pissed off, and they are not happy about dealing with the situation. So it never starts off on a good foot. But they want the road open. They may know you have the expertise, like I said, but they also may tell the fire company to hose the whole thing down with foam, no matter how many protests you have about a plan you have that you're trying to coalesce. I guess what I'm trying to say here is be careful what you wish for. Agreeing to consider this is like agreeing to go into battle in some respects. You work in a fast-paced, dynamic, and complicated situation that has a wide berth for going sideways, and if that's not for you, well then move along, citizens, nothing to see here. Now on my personal front, I used to teach incident command, and I've run rescue scenarios as a squad chief that had some parallels with potential worst case scenarios, tractor trailer wrecks, bus incidents, things like that. And I'm not smart enough to think that what I just described dissuades me. So I'll turn to the other side, the preparation triangle. What could I do to be a Boy Scout to be prepared should the call ever come? Here again, I turn to play pretend and I lean on the discussions that I've had with those who've done these things. I'm going to share you what I heard because I've asked around. By my way of thinking, a full B suit is a must, and I've been told that. You don't want to be out there in jeans and a half jacket. And to have a backup suit is an extremely good idea. Ideally, you're going to be like someone going into battle. You're going to have some kind of holster to keep your equipment with you as you work through the event, not setting your hive tools down and such. And then subsequently having spare hive tools, spare gloves, ankle, wrist tape, also all good ideas. You have to deal with the heat. You have to have a plan to deal with the heat. Headbands, handkerchiefs, maybe even a ShamWow to put on your head to absorb the sweat. You know, you're going into battle. MREs are not a poor idea because it is highly likely you're going to work for hours in a nonstop fashion and simply having a moment to go off to the side, pull up your B suit and scarf something down to keep you going in the heat of battle. That's not a dumb idea, really not out of the question. I kind of think that if you're overpacked, that's not a bad thing. And if you think that this is a possibility one day, then you're going to create a go bag separate in a duffel bag and ready to go. When they call you, they don't want to hear you say, I'll be there in an hour. They need you to get in the car and drive. I'll stop here for a moment and recognize that you're likely thinking two things. This is an interesting exercise, or this guy's off his rocker. I'm going to go on record as this is, from an exercise standpoint, really not that different from watching a spy movie on, you know, TV or something in the theater. And considering, what if you ever were facing that moment and the fate of the world is in your hands? What would you do? I kind of find it fun to explore the options. So that begs the question, will anyone ever put the fate of the world in your hands? Actually, shmaybe. I said in the past that I was on a list. Probably not the short list, mind you. But a contingency list, should this ever happen in New Jersey. It's been a while since I've heard talk about that list, so I don't know if I'm still on it, whether that list even exists anymore. But there was a time. I used to carry said kit in my vehicle. I actually did this preparation thing. But, you know, recently I realized that I went on a call and harvested the gear in my Honda CRV to do a cutout, and I didn't put it back. It's likely that moment, which happened a few weeks ago, when I looked in my storage compartment after the fact and found the kit was broken up, started this rattling around in my brain, so you have that to blame. Consider your situation. Are you near a major corridor? I presume you would not be surprised to consider that if you have a major corridor, east, west, north, south, it is extremely likely that bees are going through your area. Might be in the dead of night and you never see it as you drive around, and you can encounter it on any given day. And I hear beekeepers say this all the time, like, oh, wow, I saw a tractor trailer. Never thought I'd see one of those. And consider it doesn't have to be the worst case scenario. It might be a beekeeper coming up with 500 packages on a trailer this time of year. It could be a small scale beekeeper with 2 dozen hives. It could be that full semi with pallets of bees under a net. Any one of those would cause quite a stir. Then the question is, do you have the beekeeping skills to reassemble the colonies from a jumbled mess, whatever could happen as a result of whatever occurred on the side of the highway? And by the way, be careful not to get run over. Ideally, you would not only get the bees off the road, but you should have the acumen to help the beekeeper as much as possible when it comes to restoring what you can do of their livelihood. So if you have the skills, the resources, and the proper disposition to work in such a situation, then you would need to find somebody who's going to put you on that list. Thinking out loud, it seems logical to me that the first place to volunteer is ask at your state beekeepers association and, you know, reach out to your state apiarist. You probably need to be somebody of notoriety that they've encountered before they're actually going to consider you. That's not being mean. It's just they're not going to deal with an unknown quantity. But if you've been keeping bees for a number of years and you have a lot of bees and you have enough experience and you've been on the training scene or done things that people know who you are and understand your disposition, that does a lot to get you on the list. And so if you're not that person, but this is of interest, then get engaged in the world, and in a few years, maybe you ring the bell. It varies by location, but it's likely one of those two entities that get you on a notification list should something happen. If they're going to be the ones that are going to be called to consult with this, a state, you know, this the state president or the state apiarist. Now, the truth is, and this is another side slant of this, and it's what I know of several tellings that I've sat in on, many times the large beekeepers don't bother. They call other large beekeepers. It's almost like a call to an Amish barn raising. The beekeepers come from far and wide to the spot to help their fellow brethren. So if you know who the big guy is on the block in your region, the big producer, and you strike up a conversation and get on friendly terms with them, that could potentially get you a call. The big player beekeepers are likely, actually, on the first or second call tier, call list. And in the event of a situation that happens to happen in your neck of the woods, maybe you're a local resource ready and you'll get a call up. Consider the scene where some principal beekeepers from a few well-known outfits are there operating, and they're backed up by good old Bobby Johnson from the next town over and beekeeper Deb, who's across the river. So, are you a Bobby or perhaps a Deborah? Have you ever considered the premise? You don't get to wear a cape, but actually, when you're out there in your bee suit rescuing bees, you actually do resemble a superhero, as far as I can see it. Roundtable number 4, Queenlessness Part 2. It happens sometimes that I speak of individuals that I know and mention illustrative examples of a management practice and suggest how one might handle a situation. I always wonder, as I do that, what someone might think if they could happen upon an episode and hear their name being used in illustrative examples. I want to believe, and I take quite a bit of care not to put words in someone's illustrative mouth, and or misrepresent something that they may not believe in. Kid gloves, if you will. Interestingly enough, I sometimes actually get feedback or have connects where an individual brings up something I said and discusses my inferences with me. Such was the case of my discussion, "How long does it take a colony to know it's queenless?" In that recent roundtable, I suggested that John Gott would probably be someone in the know, given what I know about the work he's conducting in his operation. Well, as it turns out, John listened to the episode and jotted off a note with some supporting information to flush out the answer at hand. How long does it take for a colony to realize it's queenless? Kevin moment. You know, that's both awkward for me and cool at the same time. John Gott listening to the show and responding, "Damn, that's kind of cool." Recently, Medhat Nasser sent a comment about OA any day. By the way, I try to work that into every episode now. No, not really, but I just like saying it. That's cool too. When Michael Palmer sat in my EAS talk and actively participated in the exchange, I have to ask you, does it get any better than that? I love to know that such esteemed people take the time to listen. And I also love it when they share any notions of whether I was right or wrong with my assertions. And there are times that I happen to be parroting something and wondering if I have it right, and I love to have alternative assessments of what I said, pro or con. I'm truly having a moment. Just a small town boy, living in a lonely world. Yeah, okay, end of Kevin moment. Let me come back to what I'm talking about here. The video speaks for itself, both visually and through John's own words.
This colony is a queenless colony that I used just to hold queens. There wasn't any queens in this colony for about an hour, and just opened it up to put another queen in. The queen is actually in a cage, but in the last hour, this colony has figured out it is queenless and now desperately fanning to try to attract a queen that might have flown away.
Now, of course, I just played that for you, and you got to hear what John had to say in the video, but you can't see it visually. But I want to call out something that John referenced at the end of that sound clip you just listened to. In the video, the bees across the top of the frame for the five-frame nuke he was shooting were actively fanning. In the original roundtable, I said that people like John would know different biological and behavioral clues that would identify for them that the colony is hopelessly queenless. Here it is on display. So in this particular instance, John recounted a real-world experience that was about an hour for the colony to know it did not have a queen. And with that observation, you could use the input, the observation of the bees fanning, to perform your colony management, which logically would include installing a queen to restore the colony to good order. So thanks to John for sending that along. And I love it when a plan comes together. That's really cool. And this is what beekeeping, to me, the best part of it is beekeepers exchanging information with each other in the guise of both learning and teaching. And this is really kind of a cool moment. Roundtable number 5, I had a moment of reflection the other day while prepping some content for a presentation. I have a slide that I use in some of my training presentations that speaks to how bees transform during the switchover for winter. My slides are based on research that I've accumulated over time, and I can recall that the content of that particular slide came from a compendium of research articles which explored what happens to individual bees when they switch from a summer bee to a winter bee. The focus of the conversation here is the manifestation of the physical changes to the bees. What's behind that? As an example, there's a statement that describes how the flight muscles develop in the individual bee. They adapt for winter duty so that they could be used to generate warmth as part of the strategy for keeping the winter cluster to temperature as a survival mechanism. Now, not for nothing, I find that simply an amazing adaptation and one of the multitude of amazing things to know about honeybees. And I want to put a pin in that, talk about a parallel thing that I've been looking to learn a little bit more about. It has to do with honeybee immunity and pathway of change. If you listen to the show, you might have picked up on my commentary lately that I'm exploring the new queen model. One thing that researchers have told us is that queens, and subsequently the population they create as generations of bees rotate through the colony, are ever-changing. And what's unique is they change based on the locale. The viruses in one colony in a specific place, let's say my apiary in my yard, are completely different from the things that are challenging your bees in your yard. So here we can generalize that not only do bees adapt for seasonal change, they can adapt and change to the ecosystem and environment they're within. So it's great to know these things happen and be in wonder of how it all works. But there's the matter of how. How exactly does this happen at the individual colony level? I've started to see if I could find more detail and found something similar but different. And well, this is how you eventually unravel the unknown. There was a recent article that pointed me back to some work done by the USDA. There's research news about an item, SIRT and the number one. If you looked at it quick, you would call it SIRTI, S-I-R-T-I, but it's the one at the end. SIRT1 is, quote, one of the family of proteins that helps to regulate cellular lifespan, metabolism, and metabolic health and resistance to stress, end quote. Now, the news article I was reviewing was a finding that indicates they can use the levels of the protein present in the bee to assess a specific state of the bee based on conditions. As an example, bees that are stressed with colder temperatures that struggle to hold the brood nest in a colony, in this case it's 28 degrees Celsius, 82.4 Fahrenheit, have, quote, threefold lower levels of SIRT1 and significantly higher levels of colony mortality when compared to bees maintained at 34 to 35 degrees Celsius, which is 93 to 95 degrees Fahrenheit, end quote. It goes on further to say that the second temperature range, 93 to 95 degrees Fahrenheit, is the optimal core temperature of a honeybee cluster inside of a hive in winter. So isn't that interesting? 82.4, they just can't keep it to the warmth they need to, versus 93 to 95. And the SIRT1 levels are measurably different. In making the connection, here we have a protein that presents different levels when a bee is stressed and the brood nest is cold versus a colony that's holding the center of the cluster where nature intends it. This protein, SIRT1, is a physical structure in the honeybee that is impacted by the conditional surroundings, and like a bee that has physiological changes to morph from a summer bee to a winter bee, it can be measured, and based upon the finding, we can determine a specific reading of a bee's state. Now, this particular news article, of which I'll have a link to in the show notes, goes on further to extrapolate that perhaps this can parlay to a sample to see how bees are doing and indicate some information about the immune function of the individual bees. Now, we're all concerned about losses, and specifically winter losses are hard on us. And this could prove to be a novel tool for us to consider because they summed it up this way, quote, "The researchers also found that bees under cold stress were associated with an increased risk of disease infections, which in turn led to an increased likelihood of colony losses," end quote. Let's play pretend and go to the future. We are going to go do a winter assessment of our bees. We pull a single bee and do a spot check of the SRT1 protein. We end up finding that the increased stress of the particular cold winter has put stress on our bees, and some of the immune functions of the colony we know are compromised because the SIRT reading we just took says so. With that information, we might take added measures to do something in the moment or change our practices next season to provide for stronger colonies. Now, that's just play pretend, but who knows? Maybe this sub-level stuff that we have yet to learn will yield future changes for us, and we can only dream about the benefits. Now, coming back to the pin, as to what triggers a summer bee to a winter bee, there might be a protein in the background that responds to the conditional changes that starts this chemical process for the body transformation in a young larva. I'm not sure about you, but I kind of find this quest to know why somewhat fascinating and infuriating all at the same time. It sure takes you down some rabbit holes, and, well, this was a good one. Now, the commentary I offered was centered on a single news article. And I want to say, in that news article, in the body of the article, there's a research link that they were summing up. I bookmarked the article, which had the title, "Mediating a Host Cell Signaling Pathway Linked to Overwinter Mortality Offers a Promising Therapeutic Approach for Improving Bee Health." I don't expect you to remember that. As I said, there'll be a link in the show notes. But the actual article referred to research, which I bookmarked for another day. And if you're interested in that, I'll have a link to that also in the show note. And thankfully, it's a fully available research article, free for download. It's not one of those that provides an abstract and you can't get to it because it's behind a paywall. So in the end, one of the things I'm kind of, like I said, going down the rabbit hole or trying to explore is, how fast do queens and the population evolve? I'm curious about that. It's something that I've heard in the past, and I've heard researchers saying that staying with current queens and rotating your stock out frequently and so on versus go the opposite direction. Put a queen in a box and I just leave it there and I let it run for years. I could talk out of both sides of my mouth about the pros and cons of that. A long-living queen proves that she can endure the stresses put to the colony from the environment. Yet the modern, fresh, new queen is equipped to deal with changing rapidly on all the assaults that are currently there Which one of those is right, or is it somewhere in the middle? Don't know. It's a curiosity for me at the moment, and something that I've heard over time reported from researchers. And the funny thing is, they talk out of both sides of their mouth, too, because some of them are saying, you need to let your queens run for a long period of time, and others are saying you need to rotate out all the time. I don't know. I don't know if there's a proper answer. The answer, I think, is, and this comes back to just general observation, first-year queen, not too shabby. Second-year queen, in the prime of her life. Third-year queen starts to go south, and if they make it to 4 years, well, you got there, but there was quite a bit of risk. I don't like to let queens go past the second season, and being the casual beekeeper that I am sometimes, I do let hives run. I'm not adverse to, I didn't get to it, so let's see what happens, because that's how you learn. But I will tell you that as I talk to people and live my own experiences for over a decade, queen gets past 2 years, even if she was well mated and has great patterns in that second year, she starts to falter in year three. And in my notes, if a queen gets to year three, I'm going to look to replace her. And just because I know from a risk ratio, a third year queen, that colony always seems to have more challenges from the virus loads and all of that. And additionally, they don't overwinter well. Track record's not great. And I think in 3 years, the ecosystem and challenges that come to a colony mount so differently from the first year of that queen's tenure that it makes sense to switch them out. And I want to also couple this for everybody with the fact that I'm trying to find our way in the low treatment method. And one of the things I'm trying to learn is, does frequently rotating your queen mean that you can endure longer in a no chemicals in the box treatment program? Low treatment, meaning obviously, switching your queen out is not natural, so to speak. Queens would run 2 to 3 years. I'm rambling a bit, but that should hopefully make the connection of where my brain is currently in the research that I'm doing. And I thought you'd find that interesting. And also, this article was interesting. I always love learning about the different things that researchers are exploring. It kind of tells you a bit about where their headspace is. Like, they're looking at these proteins, and I know RNAi and all of that stuff is going on in research, and you only keep abreast of this if you continue to go to, you know, research articles and or conferences and hear what people are talking about in the research world. SIRT1. An interesting thing to learn about. Roundtable number 6. I'm going to call this 1-2-3s. It's been a bit of time since I've shared a recipe on the show, and I'm going to channel my inner Molly Yay on this one when I tell you that I made a recipe and actually put sprinkles on it. Molly, in case you're not familiar, is the Food Network personality that produces the cooking show called Girl Meets Farm, and one of her MOs is to put sprinkles on everything. As to the 1-2-3 aspect, it has to do with the proportion of ingredients to make this simple little treat. The ratio of ingredients is thus 1 part dark chocolate, 2 parts honey, 3 parts salted peanuts. Assembling this really doesn't get much easier. And the treat we're making is called a chocolate-covered peanut ball. Let me go through what the ingredients are, and then I'll tell you how to make it, and you'll grasp the 1-2-3. The ingredients for the honey peanut butter balls are 100 grams of dark chocolate, 200 grams of honey, and 300 grams of salted peanuts. When you make this recipe, you start with the interior, and you could choose whatever method you want to do this. Ultimately, you want to chop the peanuts up until they resemble a coarse sand. You could do this a number of ways. In the food processor, you could chop them by hand, or you could do what I did, which was give them a whirl in a small coffee grinder. Just keep pulsing it until they get to where they're supposed to be. Now, to give you a perspective of how much 3 grams of salted peanuts is, it's one of the small containers of peanuts that you find at a grocery store. Those are around, I think, 400, 450 grams, so you don't need the whole thing. It's kind of like a Coke bottle that you buy in the store, 1 liter Coke. I used salted peanuts, and if you buy plain peanuts, you should probably add a pinch of salt to the recipe as it really complements the dark chocolate well. You take your ground peanuts and you add them to a very large bowl, and I'll explain that in a second. You pour over your honey, and with clean hands, mix it until it forms something akin to a paste or a nougat. Kevin moment. If you've ever made roly-polies, which are peanut butter mixed with powdered sugar, you're looking for something very similar in texture. It's almost like a soft cookie dough when it's done. End of Kevin moment. One of the things that I said a moment ago was to use a very large bowl. It takes a touch of coercing to get the honey and the peanuts to meld together. And as you're pushing this around inside the bowl, it's very easy for them to spill over the side of a small bowl. Ask me how I know. Hence the guidance for switching to a very large bowl. Once you have this combined, you take the mixture itself in the bowl, place it in the refrigerator for around 30 minutes to firm up. You should especially do this if you're working in the time frame of year where the temps are warm, and the resulting mixture would be really soft and not hold its shape. After 30 minutes, take the mixture out of the fridge and portion it into small bite-sized balls. We used a small cookie scoop, which netted a ball that was, I think, about a teaspoon in size. Portion those out onto a rimmed cookie sheet lined with either wax or parchment paper. In the time you're doing this, the dough may be warmed through as you're portioning them out. So if you find that they softened, give them a little more time in the fridge before you coat them. So the next step is to coat them in the chocolate. And you can go down 2 paths for this. You can simply melt the chocolate in the microwave in small bursts, meaning you heat it for 10 seconds, give it a stir. And if it's not melted, put it back in, 10 seconds, give it a stir, and so on, until the chocolate's fully melted. And from there, you just dip your balls in and coat them. When it comes to candy making, though, there's a fussier process for handling the chocolate. The end result leads you to a texture of the chocolate to be more something like you would find in a boutique store. So here's where you deviate from the simple chocolate-covered peanut ball out of the microwave to something that's a little more upscale. And I'm about to describe how to temper the chocolate so that it gives you that hard, shiny coating with the telltale snap of a quality confection. I followed the method as outlined by another Food Network star that I follow, which is Alton Brown. He suggests you take a large skillet and place it on your stove. Inside, you place a small dish towel and you pour water over it until it's 1 inch deep. I know that sounds rather strange, but this is the proper way to do this, and at no point will the dish towel be at risk of catching fire because it's soaked with water. You chop your chocolate into small bits and place it in a metal bowl. The premise of what you're about to do is set that bowl down into the water, which you bring to 190 degrees. And as it's residing in the skillet and setting on the towel, not clanking on the bottom of your good skillet, it begins to melt the chocolate. And the process is you want to get the chocolate ultimately to 91 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 32 degrees Celsius or thereabouts. And in doing so, you temper the chocolate and it gives you that snap and the appearance that you want when the confection cools. So fussing a little bit over the chocolate using the method of hold the chocolate in the pot 4 to 5 seconds and then pull it out and set another towel next to your counter. Set the bowl down and stir the chocolate until it's melted. After 30 seconds of continuously stirring, move it back in to the water bath. You're setting the bowl down into the skillet on the towel. 5 seconds stirring, pull it out and stir it again for 30 seconds. You're going to repeat this process until the chocolate is completely melted and it achieves 91 degrees Fahrenheit. It sounds fussy to do, but when you do it, it's stupid simple. You're melting chocolate. You just need to make sure that you pay attention and measure the temperature. I use a probe thermometer. Once you get it to 91 degrees, pull the chocolate out, set it on the towel, bring your balls out of the refrigerator, and drop each one of them in and coat them in chocolate using a fork. Stir them around in there until it's completely covered. Pick the peanut butter ball out of the chocolate, let the excess chocolate drip off, and put it back onto the tray. As to channeling my inner Molly Yay, I had some sprinkles standing by. I did half the batch and then put sprinkles over top. If you portion the same way we did, you'll end up with 30 delectable morsels. Oh, yeah. She's from Minnesota. She talks that way. After you finish dunking and decorating the honey peanut balls, place them in the refrigerator to firm up, and then bring them back out to room temperature and put them in a container. After you've taken a photograph on a plate, of course, they are a perfect little bite. The deep peanut taste with a hint of honey sweetness, the saltiness of the peanuts, in contrast to the deep, rich taste of the dark chocolate, it's a classic combination, and I have to say, I wasn't sure if that little essence of honey coming through would make sense. But to me, it's not that far from the hint of honey that you get, say, in Honey Nut Cheerios. I added sprinkles. They look nice, but I never like sprinkles on anything, so that half of the tray is going to go to Sharon. Now, if you're interested in the written form of the recipe, visit our website and click on the link for the recipe and some pictures showing you what the textures of the peanut balls look like and so on. Just go to the website, click the link for recipes, or search for honey peanut balls. I hope that you can find some time somewhere in your future to make these. It's really not that complicated. It was fussy to describe, but easy to make. 3 ingredients, 4 if you count the sprinkles. And you could probably make a batch in around 30 minutes effort, not counting the time the stuff is chilling in the fridge. So just bang through 6 round tables, don't have a topic prepared, and not going to bring a local hive report because I didn't go in the bees at all. It's been on and off cold and chilly and windy and rainy and other things. There were probably a couple good days, but unfortunately I was working. Let's hope the weather breaks this weekend and I get a chance to peek around. I don't have a lot planned, but at some point I want to go consolidate all of the colonies down into their bottom boxes. I think it'll get warm enough where it's 45 degrees or more at night to do that. And, you know, I don't know. I have it bent on my brain this year that I want to do reversals, meaning take all of the brood, if it's up under the inner cover, and put it down in the bottom box and situate them that way. It'll give me a chance to go through all my comb too. So on a first really good warm day where I don't have to schluck at work, I will do my early spring maintenance. Managementoring kicked off the online sessions this week. Had a decent opening. Messed up, dang it, the dial-in code. I hope if you were part of that and you had a problem, sorry. Didn't realize it till in the moment. Couldn't really fix it. We'll definitely get that right next time. I wanted to mention that in the show today, you probably heard the boom, 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 bang, crash, clunk. We're renovating the house. We're doing a handful of touch-ups and yeah, Sharon's upstairs banging around doing things. So forgive the sound if it's coming through. I'm pretty sure it shows up here and there as she's laying things on the floor and taking stuff and moving furniture around and so on. I am doing something interesting this week, which is a presentation to the Big Island Beekeepers in Hawaii. Why is that interesting? Because for me to do the presentation, it's at 12:30 in the morning. I'm going to burn a little midnight oil, as it may be. Someone saw me at the Western Apiculture Society Northern Lights Beekeeping Conference, and they liked one of the presentations that I did and asked me to do it for their local club. I can't say that I have ever done a wee hours of the morning presentation. That should be fun. I'm a night owl. I can swing that. I'll sleep in a little the next morning before I... The good news is I'm working from home, and so I could pop that in. I'm looking forward to that, actually. Make your box bigger, right? Do things that you've never done before, and then, you know, it opens the opportunity for that type of thing. Anyway, I find that when I'm rambling, that's a good time to shut the show down. Like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we can accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everybody, and be well.